From NPR West, you're listening to the podcast edition of All Things Considered, the best picks from our programs on Saturday and Sunday. I'm Arun Roth. This episode, two states have legalized recreational marijuana, but setting a legal limit for drivers is incredibly complicated.
If you take 100 people and have the same blood level of marijuana, you'll have 100 different reactions.
Also, why it's so hard to make sense of the numbers when it comes to sexual violence.
The reality of rape hasn't changed. We're just doing a better job of recognizing it.
And a conversation with the one and only St. Vincent.
You know, I've said it before, but I wanted to make a party record you could play at a funeral.
That's all on this episode of All Things Considered from NPR West. In the state of Colorado, marijuana has moved from underground to behind the counter.
For cannabis, it's a gram. Okay. And grams are $20, tax included. Uh-huh. Or we have a joint.
That's just some of the selection at the Lodo Wellness Center in Denver. They've been selling medical marijuana for several years, but since January 1st, they're also selling legal recreational pot.
Great.
You all set?
Yeah, let's do it.
It may still sound funny to a lot of you, but you better get used to it. On top of Colorado, legal weed is coming soon to Washington state, and a majority of Americans now say they support full legalization. Critics have been warning of a looming public safety problem, more people driving while stoned. But there's still a lot we don't know. That's our cover story today, understanding a different kind of DUI. Inside the Lodo Wellness Center in Denver, we decided to ask shoppers just how risky they think it is to get behind the wheel while high on pot.
I don't think there is much of a risk. I really don't. I think sometimes when you get stoned on the right stuff that you're more concentrated, actually.
That was Ryan. He didn't give his last name. Several people at Lodo said it's okay to smoke before driving and definitely safer than drinking and driving.
Marijuana, you smoke about an ounce and you still have your motor skills, you know what I mean? When it comes to one shot of alcohol, all that goes out of the window.
I mean, I drink wine and driven, and I feel that that has a greater impact on accidents versus marijuana. I think you're just more cautious and more aware of things.
I mean, if you go in and you smoke five hits off a bong, you're not going to be able to go out and drive.
No, I'd be still sitting in the driveway. But I think if you smoke a joint, you're going to be fine.
To me, it doesn't seem to affect me that way. It keeps me in a focused area. I drive a little slower. I might be in the right lane with my blinker on, but that's about it.
That was Dante Cox, Laura and Oscar Coleman, and Damian Kanjemi. For advocates of traffic safety, their words are very concerning.
I think this is the next big issue in highway safety.
Jonathan Adkins is the executive director of the Governor's Highway Safety Association.
There's this prevalent feeling in our culture that marijuana is no big deal. Well, it is a big deal if you use it and then get behind the wheel. We need to have the same cultural intolerance for marijuana use behind the wheel as we do with alcohol.
Alcohol-related crashes still kill around 10,000 Americans a year. And we understand quite clearly the danger it poses as an enormous public health problem. The impact of marijuana is much less clear. Dr. Marilyn Hustis is with the National Institute on Drug Abuse, and she's done extensive research on marijuana's effect on driving ability. The results, she says, should give smokers pause.
We have so many processes in our brain that help us to do a complex behavior of driving, and under the effects of marijuana, we just don't perform as well.
After using marijuana, she says people generally have more trouble staying in lanes, they struggle to do multiple tasks at once, and there's a real problem maintaining concentration on long, monotonous drives. But how often does marijuana use actually cause accidents?
Studies that have looked at the crash risk associated with marijuana have produced mixed results.
That's Anne McCart. She's a senior vice president for research at the Insurance Institute for Highway Safety.
Not only do we not have consensus on the risk associated with the presence of marijuana, we don't have information on the crash risk for different amounts of marijuana. And we don't even have good information on how many drivers involved in fatal crashes test positive for marijuana. So there's a lot we don't know.
Even with the lack of information we have, is it possible to rank marijuana and compared to alcohol or other drugs in terms of the dangers it poses for driving?
Well, we generally know less about other drugs than marijuana, but I think the evidence thus far suggests that there is a stronger effect of alcohol on crash risk than marijuana. We just have a large body of very strong research on the strong association between blood alcohol concentrations and crash risk. We've used that science, for example, to enact in all 50 states laws that make it illegal to drive with BACs of 0.08% or higher. We don't have comparable information on marijuana.
You follow traffic safety issues, really, for a living. As marijuana becomes more accepted in the U.S., how concerned are you about the impact of that on driver safety?
I think it is concerning. And as a researcher, I think it's frustrating that we don't have the science that we need at this point to craft effective, enforceable laws for drugs, including marijuana. I think policymakers don't have the information that they need on the crash risk associated with marijuana to really know how to proceed.
And here the comparison with alcohol is especially telling. At this point, we're used to the public service announcements reminding us of the legal limit.
It's a lot easier than you think to blow a .08. Drive sober, arrive alive.
Police around the country carry handheld breathalyzers that test for blood alcohol content. But coming up with a similar test for marijuana, that's more difficult, much more. For one, we all know the alcohol content of a Budweiser, but it's a lot harder to know the potency of a wide variety of marijuana products. And here's another complication. Pot's main psychoactive ingredient is THC, and it can linger in the body long after the initial high. Dr. Timothy Fong is a professor of psychiatry and an addiction specialist at UCLA.
THC is a molecule that really loves human fat. And when you ingest it, it sticks in the fat and then it slowly seeps out over the course of a week or a month if you're a heavy user.
The most reliable test for THC is the blood test. A few states, like Washington and Colorado, have even established a kind of legal limit for marijuana in the blood, 5 nanograms of THC per milliliter. But performing that test often requires that police drive a suspect to a hospital, except in Arizona, where police are trained to draw blood themselves. And Dr. Fong says it's tough to interpret exactly what those tests mean for driving ability.
Most of the marijuana testing have been done in human laboratories, and there you get a wide variety. So if you take 100 people and have the same blood level of marijuana, you'll have 100 different reactions.
California has been at the leading edge of the legal marijuana movement. In 1996, it became the first state to legalize medical marijuana. The state's Office of Traffic Safety recently conducted a roadside study at night, and they found around 7% of drivers had marijuana in their systems. Now Los Angeles is at the forefront of law enforcement's response. The city has a federal grant to try out a new roadside drug test, oral swabs. Mike Feuer is the city attorney of Los Angeles, and he calls the technology the wave of the future.
This is a technique under which, in the field, at the time of the traffic stop, an officer can test the saliva of the driver and get an immediate result as to whether there are drugs present in his or her system.
And with this being a new technique, or at least maybe something that a lot of people might be unfamiliar with, is there an issue of admissibility in court and getting that to be recognized?
The admissibility in court of the swabbing hasn't been tested in California. It is likely to be tested sometime in the coming months or perhaps next year. It also could be down the road that there is legislation initiated in California. All of us want to assure that we have as effective a means as possible of determining whether a driver is impaired, not merely because we want to effectively prosecute that driver, but we do want to do everything we can to prevent driving while under the influence in the first place. And the more commonly known it is that we have a quick and effective technique for determining that, the more I hope people are deterred from getting behind the wheel with drugs or alcohol in their system.
Advocates who favor marijuana legalization say they agree people should know their limits and should not drive while impaired. But they're concerned that police officers will substitute this new technology and an arbitrary legal limit for their own judgment. Here's Mason Tavert. He's the communications director for the Marijuana Policy Project, a pro-legalization group.
I think that people want to have a clear-cut black and white solution. They want a specific number that we can use to just say this person is impaired or not. Unfortunately, it's a little more of a gray area than that. So what we really need to be doing is really judging people's impairment. And that really ends up being a matter of field sobriety tests and using the law enforcement official's judgment. Simply having a number that we know is not necessarily indicative of impairment doesn't really accomplish much and could actually result in people who are perfectly sober being arrested and charged with being impaired while driving.
Is there a concern that with maybe a fair number of new marijuana users in these states, that these new users could get on the road under the influence and basically set back the gains that your group has made in terms of pot legalization?
Quite frankly, I'm really more concerned about excessive and overzealous reporting on the subject as opposed to actual problems. People driving under the influence of marijuana has never proven to be a huge problem. It's something that we need to address and discourage. And when someone does drive while impaired, we need to ensure that they are penalized. But we allow adults to use alcohol responsibly, and we punish adults if they use it irresponsibly, and that includes driving while drunk. We should be doing the same thing with marijuana.
In fact, that's an area of some common ground. Again, Mike Feuer, the city attorney of Los Angeles.
There have been so many tragedies that are completely avoidable, that devastate families in ways from which they never recover. So I'm optimistic that as the debate around legalization of marijuana continues in this country, there will be no debate, complete unanimity around the notion that we should be educating the public about the fact that driving while impaired could lead another family to suffer a loss from which they can never recover.
That legalization debate Mike Feuer mentioned is continuing this year. There's a good chance marijuana initiatives will be on the ballot in Alaska and Oregon. But even as the momentum increases for marijuana legalization, police and lawmakers say they have to respond, even with so much still unknown. There are thousands of saints recognized by the Catholic Church. But canonization, the process of declaring a person a saint, requires a long, rigorous, and expensive process. Just outside Buffalo, in Lackawanna, New York, Our Lady of Victory Basilica is midway through that process for Father Nelson Baker. Father Baker was ordained in 1876 and spent nearly his entire ministry at that church, where he developed a small orphanage and a school.
He also founded a home for unwed mothers, adoption program, and a foster care program for vulnerable children.
That's Monsignor Paul Burkhard, pastor at Our Lady of Victory. He says Rome accepted Father Baker's case back in 1988, and they've been progressing towards canonization ever since.
What stands out in Rome's mind most of all is his heroic virtue of charity toward the poor.
Father Baker is a household name in the Buffalo Diocese. Burkhard says the congregation has enthusiastically contributed to his case.
Locally, of course, he's already considered a saint, so there's a lot of support in the western New York and Pennsylvania and New England area and southern Canada. And nationally, we have people who have been attached to the cause who also contribute to that, the Father Baker Guild on a regular basis.
The total cost of Father Nelson Baker's canonization? About $250,000. Monsignor Burkhard says they've raised about half that. Why is so much time and money invested in this process?
The church is very careful about declaring saints. They don't want to make somebody a saint and the next day have to say, oops, there were actually skeletons in this person's closet.
That's John Allen, the associate editor at the Boston Globe.
You have to get one miracle to beatify someone, that is to declare them blessed, and another miracle, typically, to canonize them, that is to declare them a saint. And those miracle reports have to be scoured by teams of doctors to make sure there's no scientific explanation, and by teams of theologians to make sure it passes doctrinal muster. all of that expertise takes time and it takes money. And then, as I say, the largest single line item in any sainthood process typically is the canonization ceremony at the end. So to some extent, how expensive making a saint is depends on how popular this figure is, and therefore how big a crowd they're going to get at the end. Some of the lesser-known causes can be done on the cheap, but if you've got a superstar saint, for example, Padre Pio, the famed Capuchin Stigmatic in Italy, you can be looking at in excess of $1 million. Groups in the church that have resources are in a better position to be able to do all that.
And how long does the process typically take?
Well, some processes take centuries because there has not been a documented miracle report, or for a variety of different reasons, the process just didn't reach conclusion. On the other hand, John Paul II, the late pope, of course, died in 2005, and he is going to be declared a saint by Pope Francis on April 27th. That process moved from soup to nuts in a relatively breathtakingly short period of 8 years.
And in terms of the figure who goes from being, you know, venerable or blessed to becoming a full saint, how are their causes benefited?
Not only is it a kind of papal seal of approval on the whole organization, but of course they get enormous international publicity. That said, I think there are some groups in the church, particularly those who are most directly concerned with outreach to the poor, that sometimes feel a little bit of ambivalence about the whole sainthood thing. But I think the overwhelming majority of Catholic groups feel that it is definitely worth the investment.
John, thank you very much.
It was a pleasure.
A lot of obscure bands want to reach a national audience, and they send their records to NPR. Unfortunately, most of them aren't great. This CD, for instance, is the type of thing we'd usually just toss. It's got a pair of singles, each from a different band. One by the Blue Jean Committee, who came out of the 1970s Massachusetts folk scene. And this one you're hearing now, it's the Fingerlings. They're a post-disco synth band from Bath, England, who formed an art college. Sounds just dreadful.
Standing in the motel room, looking out at the neon lights.
But before chucking it out, we noticed the name Fred Armisen on there. For those of you who haven't seen him on Saturday Night Live or Portlandia, Fred is a musical chameleon, and a hilarious one. See, these bands don't actually exist. They're fictional. The backstories, fake. But the songs, well, you're hearing them now. They're real.
All I can say is embrace me.
The Fingerlings first appeared in an SNL skit. Fred Armisen and Dana Carvey and their band, complete with new wave wigs and trench coats, take the stage at a rapidly emptying bar full of Packers fans as the Super Bowl kicks off.
Your fingers trace my lips as we drove through the Paris night. Weeping in the pouring rain with blue mascara running down my face.
It's great. You can hear the crowd laughing. It's not because Fred's songs are parodies or crammed full of jokes like Weird Al Yankovic or Flight of the Conchords. The comedy emerges from the weird, uncomfortable tension that comes from the band's being totally serious.
At the risk of sounding like I have like fake humility, like I'm not good at putting jokes in songs. You know what I mean? There are people who are really good at that and they've got like a punchline or something, but for me it's just more been about just like the texture of it all.
Case in point, Sparkling Apple Juice by the Bejelland Brothers.
2, 3, I sent a bottle of sparkling apple juice to your house. Did you get it?
Oh, remember the
I
song?
I sent a bottle of sparkling.
And that's pretty much the song. Armisen, along with Bryan Cranston, both bewigged, singing on a giant stage in front of a very sparse crowd. The skit gets its laughs from jokes sprinkled into the script, not the song itself.
Can you all see us, people in the back? Can we turn the house lights up a little? We want to see the crowd. Huh, look at that. There are not that many people here tonight. No.
You know, sometimes for the sketches, you need some kind of opposing factor just to make the comedy of it. Oh my God, I can't believe I'm talking about comedy like it's a serious thing. I'm so sorry. Anyway, for some of those sketches, you need an opposing thing just to make it, you know, give it a point.
But on these new singles, there's no opposing thing. No angry football fans or awkward audience reactions. These are studio versions. What's weird is that songs like Embrace Me are even funnier when they're standing there naked.
Dancing with my trousers off in a disco in Berlin. All I can say is embrace me. Embrace me.
And Fred's gone the whole distance with cover art and the serious sounding press release.
I wanted it to appear real. I didn't want it to seem too jokey. I wanted the records to be mistaken for the real thing.
Fred Armisen's name is on there for songwriting purposes, but he says he wishes there was a way to make it even more covert.
I just like the idea of local music heroes, you know, those bands that were on the cusp of becoming nationally famous, but they just stayed sort of regional, but they were still famous where they're from. So in a way, like, it would make sense that the person buying the record has never heard of them because only the people in their town have heard of them.
That thinking inspired the other band in the new release, the Blue Jean Committee.
We come from a little place called Northampton, Massachusetts. You guys heard of it? I think you have. Yeah?
In this skit from 2011, the Blue Jean Committee steps onto the stage at a small bar, clearly in Northampton. Guest host Jason Siegel is on keyboards, Fred Armisen on guitar and vocals, both sporting wigs and awful all-denim outfits.
Let me ask you a question. Do you ever have one of those afternoons that you wish would never end? What I'd like to do right now is paint you a little picture of what that's like. Massachusetts afternoon, hanging out on the porch, drinking cinnamon beer with you.
Armisen says Massachusetts Afternoon was an easy pick for the first single. He actually loves the song like that, just on its own. He got the idea when he saw a jazz band perform a song called Louisiana Afternoon. He was struck by the beauty of the song and the way the word Louisiana just flowed with the music.
And I thought, what's the opposite of this? What's a state in the United States where it would sound more clinical, where it doesn't sound very good? No disrespect to the state of Massachusetts. It just doesn't lend itself to that kind of romantic notion.
Massachusetts afternoon, staying at my cousin's place, I write love letters to you.
I asked Fred if he's managed to fool anyone into thinking these were real bands.
Unfortunately, not yet. It is a real wish of mine that someone will mistake it for the real thing.
Yeah, if you want to find me and the guys, we'll be at the Empty Glass Inn playing poo with Old Man Jones. And beautiful Lucia with those long Northampton legs dancing to the jukebox all night long.
Sorry to spoil the surprise for all of you listening. The first single is out now with the Blue Jean Committee and the Fingerlings. The second, with the Bajeland Brothers and Taste of New York, will come out in March. Fred is no longer on SNL, but that doesn't mean he's done with songs like this. Armisen will continue the jokes as the band leader at the new Late Night with Seth Meyers, which premieres this Monday. He says it'll be just straight stuff at first, but Meyers has hinted that we'll be seeing more Armisen characters.
I write love letters to you, Massachusetts afternoon.
Michio Kaku is famous for explaining some of the weirder mysteries of the universe in books like Hyperspace. But he has shifted his attention to a much smaller system, the brain. Kaku shifts from physics to neuroscience for his new book called The Future of the Mind. He says we can think of the brain as a large corporation.
Now, we used to think the brain was like a computer. But now we realize that's not true. There's no programming of the brain. There's no Windows. And we think the brain is more like a large corporation. Because think of the unconscious mind. In a corporation, you have subdivisions which operate independently of the main office. And that's why we have an unconscious mind, because you have to have, for example, emotional reactions to things very quickly. And so the organization of the brain is, in some sense, very much like a large bureaucracy.
I know this is something you wrestle with in the book. How does something like consciousness emerge out of this corporation?
Well, consciousness, there are about 20,000 papers on consciousness with no consensus. Nowhere in history have so many people devoted so much time to produce so little. But our consciousness differs because we simulate the future. Animals have no conception of tomorrow. We do. We constantly are daydreaming, constantly planning for tomorrow, constantly thinking about things that happen even beyond our lifetime.
It sounds related to a similar definition that I've heard in the past from philosophers, that what sets us apart is that a knowledge of our own mortality, the idea that there will one day not be a me.
That's right. We can imagine things far beyond our body. And so these are three levels of consciousness. Consciousness one level is understanding where we are in space. Consciousness two is where we understand our position in society, who's top dog, who's underdog, and who's in the middle. And type three consciousness is simulating the future. And type three consciousness, only humans have this ability to see far into the future.
Can you talk about what modern technology has been able to tell us about the mystery of consciousness?
Well, we've learned more in the last 10, 15 years than in all of human history. In fact, we can take the consciousness of somebody who is totally paralyzed, cannot do anything with their body, put a chip in their brain, and have that person control a laptop. They can now surf the web. They can now write emails, answer emails, control their wheelchair, control household appliances, and even manipulate mechanical arms and eventually a mechanical exoskeleton. Stephen Hawking, my colleague, is totally paralyzed, and he has a chip in his right glass. Next time you see him on television, look at his right frame, and you see a brain sensor, which picks up radio from his brain and allows him to type mentally.
And the fact that our brains and bodies can interface with machines in this way, what does that tell us about, you know, our idea of ourself and our consciousness?
Well, President Barack Obama stunned the scientific community last year in his State of the Union address, announcing the Brain Project. Just like the Human Genome Project revolutionized genetics and medicine, the Brain Project of America and the European Union will allocate over $1 billion to map all the sequences and pathways of the human brain. The short-term goal is to understand and cure mental illness, one of the greatest afflictions in the history of the human race. The Bible mentions mental illness, for example. And even beyond that, if you have a CD-ROM with all our pathways on it, that's sort of like Brain 2.0. Philosophers have asked the question, if we have a CD-ROM with all our neural pathways on it, perhaps consciousness is nothing but information, and this information can live forever. This has philosophical implications.
Isn't that, couldn't you say that that's kind of reductive, though, that just because these processes can be mirrored by machines or even, you know, mimicked by machines, you're still, that's not the same as if you're mapping out all the neurons. That's not the same thing as getting the essence of a person, of that self.
Well, it all depends on how you define the word you. What are you? If you are a mass of soft tissue and bones and so on and so forth, then you're absolutely right. These things look like no more than sophisticated tape recorders. They are not conscious in the sense that our neurons are conscious. But if that set of neurons, mechanical transistors, eventually becomes so sophisticated it's basically a carbon copy, then perhaps there's a new definition of you. Perhaps you can exist independent of your body. Now, of course, we've seen this on Star Trek. We've seen this in the movies. But now things that we think of as science fiction are now entering the laboratories of people working on this brain initiative, this $1 billion initiative to understand mental illness and what is the human consciousness.
Would you want your brain to be downloaded to have a copy made of your mind?
Well, you know, in the movie Back to the Future, Doc Brown is asked the question, do you want to see the future? And he says, I've always wanted to see beyond my years.
I've always dreamed of seeing the future, looking beyond my years, seeing the progress of mankind.
Why not?
I'd also be able to see who wins the next 25 World Series.
You see, I'm also a futurist. I dream about the world 50, 100, maybe even 1,000 years into the future, but I also realize I'm probably not going to see it. However, I wouldn't mind. I wouldn't mind having at least a copy of myself see the future, maybe 50, 100, 1,000 years into the future. It would be a fantastic ride.
Michio Kaku's new book is called The Future of the Mind. Thank you so much.
Glad to be on your show.
It's time for the new and the next. Carlos Watson is the co-founder of the online magazine Aussie. Each week he joins us to talk about what's new and what's next. Welcome back, Carlos.
Arun, great to be with you.
So here's a situation that anybody who's been a freelancer in like the last 10 years has faced. You need that precious Wi-Fi at the coffee shop, but how many cappuccinos do you have to buy to justify sitting there all day? And finally, somebody saw an opportunity there, right?
So for those who are not shameless like you and me and are willing just to buy one and sit there for 8 hours, there's now a new option called pay-as-you-go cafes where instead of paying for the coffee, you actually just pay for the amount of time you're there. Some of the spots are only literally a nickel a minute, so about $3 an hour. But it's taken off in Europe as well as South America.
It's great because, I mean, if you've been in that situation, as I have, you're doing this constant like moral math in your head. Well, it's not too crowded so I can hang around a bit longer, or do I need to buy a second one to justify my spot? Or it's surprising nobody thought about this before.
One of the places called Urban Station has been around since 2009, and the other place called Zifferblatt, which now you can enjoy in London, among other places, really got its start in Russia. But a lot of young people and a lot of just freelancers in general are finding this makes all the sense in the world. And for less than $5 an hour, I have kind of a clean, safe place to do my work without any kind of moral shame or discomfort.
It's nice to work without moral shame. So I'm hearing Russia, Europe, Latin America. So are we going to get some of these in America?
You know, at the moment, we have not. And the answer is kind of simple. It hasn't been profitable enough. Again, people are charging the equivalent of about a nickel a minute. And, you know, when you talk about some of the real estate prices and other things here in the States, it may be harder to make it work here than it is, say, in Istanbul or Bogota.
So that double frappuccino or whatever might actually make more money than charging you for the space.
You know, indeed.
Well, that's too bad. Well, hopefully it'll work out here soon enough. Finally, you have a very interesting story about a biotech boom in a place that people might not expect. It's set it up by quoting Spinal Tap. Hello, Cleveland.
Cleveland, which is my hometown, by the way, Arun.
I did not know that.
Very, very true.
I'll hold the jokes.
Please do. It is no longer the mistake by the lake. We now refer to it as the fury by the Erie. While lots of folks thought about the Rust Belt and thought about the struggling manufacturing sector there, a whole new area has boomed, and in particular, medical technology companies that are spinning out of the Cleveland Clinic and several other universities there and now are providing just under 500,000 jobs.
Wow. I know about this because I actually have visited the Cleveland Clinic. They have a brain health center that's actually in Nevada, of all places, doing amazing cutting-edge work.
The Cleveland Clinic recognized that a lot of the brilliant research they were doing had practical application, and close to 100 companies have spun out of some of the work that's happened there and at surrounding institutions. And in fact, the city of Cleveland has set aside a 1,600-acre parcel where you see lots of innovative companies, including one that we profiled this week called HeartLab, are doing lots of good and important work.
So you moving back?
Not anytime soon. I love this California weather. I'm still a Cleveland Browns fan, love the Cleveland Indians, even the Cavaliers, but happy to see that there's more than just sports to cheer for these days.
Great. Carlos Watson is the co-founder of the online magazine Aussie. You can explore all the stories we talked about at npr.org/new and next. Carlos, thanks again.
Arun, always good to be with you.
It's All Things Considered from NPR West. I'm Arun Roth. The FBI released its semi-annual Uniform Crime Report last week. The study tallies crime statistics submitted from local law enforcement agencies across the country. Overall, violent crime decreased about 5% between 2012 and 2013. Reports of rape increased, but the numbers don't tell the whole story.
The reality of rape hasn't changed. We're just doing a better job of recognizing it.
Scott Berkowitz is with the Rape, Abuse, Incest National Network, an organization that provides support for survivors of sexual violence. He says the increase in reports of rape has to do with a change in the FBI's longstanding definition of the crime. Before last year, the definition of rape for the FBI was carnal knowledge of a woman by a man, forcibly and against her will.
They took out the word force. Most rapes are committed without a weapon and often just with threats. I think the bigger part of the change is that under the old definition, only rapes of women were counted. before last year, when a man was raped, for federal purposes, it didn't count. Hmm. Under the new definition, the FBI is now saying, send us all your reports, men and women. We're going to count them all.
So with the expanded definition, the number of rapes are up in most cities. Berkowitz says that since the definition excluded male rape for so long, it's hard to know the full scope of the issue. But there are some estimates.
Other studies the Justice Department has done suggest that about one out of every 33 men will be sexually assaulted during their lifetime. And that compares to about one out of every six women.
Since this is a new definition, can we even talk about trends? You know, does this become the new baseline and now we have to sort of start over again in talking about understanding sexual violence?
Pretty much. But there's actually two different ways that the federal government measures sexual violence. One is this FBI study, which tallies the number of police reports that are made in local police departments around the country. The other is a broader study where they interview a random sample of tens of thousands of households and ask them a series of questions. And if someone answers yes to one of the sexual violence questions, they'll ask follow-up questions like, did you report it to police? So from that study, which gives us a much broader picture of the problem because it counts unreported rapes, that shows us that there's been a significant decline in sexual violence over the last 20 years. It's fallen by somewhere around half, but that decline has really leveled off in the last few years, and the numbers have stopped going down. One of the unique things about sexual violence is that it's one of the most underreported crimes. According to the Justice Department, only about 4 out of 10 victims report their rape to police.
And do you think the new definition, even the different wording, is it possible that that could reduce the stigma to an extent and increase the reporting?
I think so. We've heard from lots of men who've contacted the National Sexual Assault Hotline who have a feeling that by expanding this definition, by recognizing that they're real victims, I guess is how they often put it, it helps validate their experience. It makes them feel like what happened to them is understood by authorities. It's interesting. Ever since the Penn State story broke a couple of years ago, which was focused, of course, on boys who had been abused, we saw a huge increase after that in the number of boys and men contacting the hotline, and that has continued to grow.
The new language that the FBI uses, obviously you consider that an improvement, but are there other changes that you would like to see or other information you'd like to see the FBI collecting?
You know, I think that what we still need a better understanding of is why are 6 out of 10 rapes not reported to police? What's stopping people? Because the only way we're ever going to really put a big dent in sexual violence is once more rapes are reported to police and more are prosecuted.
Scott Berkowitz is the founder and president of the Rape, Abuse, Incest National Network, the nation's largest anti-sexual violence organization. This is just the first year that the new definition of rape has been in place, and not all local police departments are using it. The Police Executive Research Forum has been working to help local agencies with the change. Chuck Wexler is the executive director.
I hope by the end of this year you'd have 100% or close to 100% participation, but the definition had not changed in 100 years, so sometimes it's challenging to get bureaucratic organizations to change.
As more law enforcement agencies use the new definition and more data become available, we may start to have a clearer picture of sexual violence in America. Leah Vincent had already traveled an amazing distance by the time she was an adult. Vincent grew up in a Yeshivish community in Pennsylvania, but was forced to leave as a teenager and eventually ended up cut off completely, alone in New York City. The Yeshivish are an ultra-Orthodox Jewish sect. Religion is at the center of their life, and strict rules regulate all daily activities. Especially restricted are any interactions with the opposite sex. But Leah says when she was young, the rules didn't feel oppressive.
When I was a child, it was really a beautiful and wonderful thing. You know, I was one of 11 children, and it was kind of easy to get lost in that. But I felt like I was doing what God wanted, and that imbued my daily life with so much meaning and joy and intensity, which was really very wonderful to feel like God had reached down from the sky and tapped me on the shoulder and chosen me to be his daughter, which is how it was phrased to us. It was only once my adolescence started to unfold and I started to have desires and interests that went beyond the world I was supposed to fit into, that things started to become more tense and there more conflicts arose.
And those desires, what happens is you end up expressing them in a way which outside of the community would look quite innocuous and even kind of sweet and innocent. Can you talk about how that came to pass?
Sure. So there were a few big moments that really symbolized this tension that was building. One of them was I was sent away to a more yeshivish, more religious school in Manchester, England, and I befriended a girl who had a very cute older brother. And girls were not allowed to talk to boys, but because he was my friend's older brother, I had some contact with him. And he was not as yeshivish as my family, and he introduced me to the idea of going to college, that one could be religious and a good person and still go to college, which was forbidden in my sect. And maybe I was, probably pretty heavily influenced by the fact that I was 15 and had a major crush on this guy. But I started thinking, I want to go to college. And I called my mom back home, Pittsburgh, and I said, I am thinking about going to college. It's something I want to do. And she said, if you try to go to college, we'll have you locked up. So they reacted very strongly to this desire. And then a little bit later on, I was in Israel. It was found out that I had been writing letters to the same boy. And it really led to a big break between me and my extended family and my community.
And you were just, as you said, you were just exchanging notes with this boy, but that was something that was absolutely forbidden, unacceptable.
Yeah, there was not allowed to be any contact between adolescent girls and boys. And once it was known that I was talking to a boy, I immediately moved to sort of a second-class citizenship because, I wasn't pure, I wasn't good, I had violated some taboo. And I just ended up in this precarious position where I was branded a rebel and a bad girl, but I had no desire of my own to move out into the world. I still loved our way of life. I had just made a few mistakes.
Well, it's one of the things that's so sad about this part of your journey is that it's not like you're not a non-believer. You're not even questioning your faith, your belief in God, or even the morality of it that deeply. It's just a couple of things that completely turn it upside down for you.
Yeah, I'm almost embarrassed now when I share stories with other people who have similar journeys. Like, I wasn't the feminist. I wasn't the forward-thinking intellectual. I just was a teenager, and I made some mistakes, but I desperately for years clung to this desire to stay within the world I grew up in.
So how did you wind up in New York City?
So that was kind of a common move. That's where the really large yeshivish community is, and so people who have families outside of that will send their daughters and their sons to New York to be matched up by a matchmaker to get married. So that was kind of expected. What was unexpected was the lack of support and communication that came along with that. So I was 17 in New York City, and nobody was trying to find me. Nobody was talking about, okay, soon we'll try to find you a match. Nobody was really talking to me, period. So I was in the right place, but nothing else was lined up.
And what's also hard to imagine, so you grew up, to put it mildly, in a very sheltered you had a very sheltered childhood, but then you're in New York City, kind of sin central.
Yeah. And, perhaps another way to talk about it is that this is a story about a lot of sex and sexual trauma, and yet I grew up in I don't know if that's the synonym for sin that you're looking at, but that I grew up in this very sheltered world. But I actually think it's not as paradoxical as it might look at first glance, because I think when girls are raised in communities or homes that obsess over modesty, they're actually, it's just like a dust cloth over this sexuality that ends up defining them. And when they're put in other circumstances, it leaves them very vulnerable to the kind of things that I went through. I was raised where my most important goal was to always stay modest because I believe I had some huge sexual power that could cause men to sin. And engaging with that power in different ways, most of them unhealthily at the beginning, became a coping mechanism. But I think if I was raised in a home where I had been taught that I had many tools and many things that were important about my life and many things I could contribute to the world, I think that it wouldn't have been my life would not have gone from one extreme to the other as it did.
Do you have any communication now with your family or your old community?
Most of my family won't speak to me anymore. But as I mentioned in the book, I have one brother who also left ultra-Orthodoxy after I did, and he and I have a wonderful relationship, and he has a family, and it's so beautiful. After having lost everybody, he has a son, and I have a daughter, and they can play together, and I can know that I'm giving my child some family, even though I lost so much.
Leah Vincent's new book is called Cut Me Loose, Sin and Salvation After My Ultra-Orthodox Girlhood. Leah, thank you so much.
Thank you so much. My pleasure.
We'll be right back. There are thousands of saints recognized by the Catholic Church. But canonization, the process of declaring a person a saint, requires a long, rigorous, and expensive process. Just outside Buffalo, in Lackawanna, New York, Our Lady of Victory Basilica is midway through that process for Father Nelson Baker. Father Baker was ordained in 1876 and spent nearly his entire ministry at that church, where he developed a small orphanage and a school.
He also founded a home for unwed mothers, adoption program, and a foster care program for vulnerable children.
That's Monsignor Paul Burkhard, pastor at Our Lady of Victory. He says Rome accepted Father Baker's case back in 1988, and they've been progressing towards canonization ever since.
What stands out in Rome's mind most of all is his heroic virtue of charity toward the poor.
Father Baker is a household name in the Buffalo Diocese. Burkhard says the congregation has enthusiastically contributed to his case.
Locally, of course, he's already considered a saint, so there's a lot of support in the western New York and Pennsylvania and New England area and southern Canada. And nationally, we have people who have been attached to the cause who also contribute to that, the Father Baker Guild on a regular basis.
The total cost of Father Nelson Baker's canonization? About $250,000. Monsignor Burkhard says they've raised about half that. Why is so much time and money invested in this process?
The church is very careful about declaring saints. They don't want to make somebody a saint and the next day have to say, oops, there were actually skeletons in this person's closet.
That's John Allen, the associate editor at the Boston Globe.
You have to get one miracle to beatify someone, that is to declare them blessed, and another miracle, typically, to canonize them, that is to declare them a saint. And those miracle reports have to be scoured by teams of doctors to make sure there's no scientific explanation, and by teams of theologians to make sure it passes doctrinal muster. All of that expertise takes time, and it takes money. And then, as I say, the largest single line item in any sainthood process typically is the canonization ceremony at the end. So to some extent, how expensive making a saint is depends on how popular this figure is, and therefore how big a crowd they're going to get at the end. Some of the lesser-known causes can be done on the cheap, but if you've got a superstar saint, for example, Padre Pio, the famed Capuchin Stigmatic in Italy, you can be looking at in excess of $1 million. Groups in the church that have resources are in a better position to be able to do all that.
And how long does the process typically take?
Well, some processes take centuries because there has not been a documented miracle report, or for a variety of different reasons, the process just didn't reach conclusion. On the other hand, John Paul II, the late pope, of course, died in 2005, and he is going to be declared a saint by Pope Francis on April 27th. That process moved from soup to nuts in a relatively breathtakingly short period of 8 years.
And in terms of the figure who goes from being, venerable or blessed to becoming a full saint, how are their causes benefited?
Not only is it a kind of papal seal of approval on the whole organization, but of course they get enormous international publicity. That said, I think there are some groups in the church, particularly those who are most directly concerned with outreach to the poor, that sometimes feel a little bit of ambivalence about the whole sainthood thing. But I think the overwhelming majority of Catholic groups feel that it is definitely worth the investment.
John, thank you very much.
It was a pleasure.
It's All Things Considered from NPR West. I'm Arun Roth. Over the years, the Catholic Church has recognized over a dozen St. Vincents. But there's only one St. Vincent who can do this.
Goodbye.
St. Vincent is the stage name of Annie Clark. Her musical gifts are dazzling. Dense, layered songs with wicked horn arrangements and a canny melodic sense and a ton of soul. She's worked with some of the most celebrated indie rockers around. A 2012 collaboration with David Byrne marked the culmination of a period of intense touring and recording. But it was exhausting. Annie decided she needed a break to get away from it all. Luckily, for her fans at least, it didn't last long.
I got home after the first leg of the Love This Giant tour, and I thought, you know what, I'm just going to unplug and forget about the world for a little bit. But it took me about 36 hours to start just digging in and writing this record. I took a long bath. I had a good night's sleep. I maybe watched a movie and ate a meal, and then I was kind of back to work.
Maybe a day's all you need.
Yeah.
Well, clearly, because this new album is fantastic.
Thank you so much.
And this is kind of the solitude thing makes a natural sort of segue into the first song, Rattlesnake. Am I the only one in the only world? You're asking if you're the only one in the world.
I think if I took a Myers-Briggs test, which in fact I have taken a Myers-Briggs test, but I can't remember.
Yeah.
You know, I can't remember my acronym, but I think it's somewhere definitely on the more introverted scale, but I need that time, you know, me and a guitar or me and a computer or me and a keyboard or whatever.
I want to talk about the process a little bit. Maybe one of the songs might be a good way to go through it. Let's talk about Birth in Reverse. I want to think that the groove came first.
You know what came first, actually, is all the music and the melody. I was doing that thing that often songwriters will do. I was just kind of mouthing nonsensical words, and in some cases just, you know, like, you know, like whatever. You know what I'm saying? The dogs will bark, so let them bark. That song, for example, is one that it really didn't change that much from the demo. So this record was a little bit less of a process of discovery in the studio and more about, okay, execution. These songs are written, so let's get in there and bang them out with great players.
My guest is Annie Clark. She performs as St. Vincent. Her new self-titled album comes out on Tuesday. You know, there's this amazing tension that I feel in your music. It's been in all your albums where dissonances and distortions, you make them sound beautiful, and then there can be a simple melody, and then when that comes through, it's disturbing.
I just do that because that feels very natural, and that's what's going on in my brain. So, of course, that would manifest itself in the music, and some things that people even find ugly or harsh don't register to me as ugly or harsh. I'm just like, oh, that's beautiful. I don't get it. But okay, yeah, I guess if I take a step back, I can see how that's not everybody's cup of tea all the time.
You don't sit down and say, I'm going to find the beauty in that hideous thing or vice versa.
No, I think it's all, you know, it's like people, like just these weird petri dishes of emotion and reason and all this. So that's the same thing with music. I love it all. I thought you were like a dog.
I thought you were like a dog. Your songs seldom have a single, simple, identifiable mood. There are different things going on, just where there are different instruments with different lines. There are different emotions, sometimes contradictory emotions, it feels, at play in the same time. Mm-hmm. I think of something like Every Tear Disappears, that there's a lot of different feelings.
Yeah. Well, I mean, to me, I was like, oh, this is a really hopeful song with a hopeful message. Because it's true. Every tear does disappear. You know, I've said it before, but I wanted to make a party record you could play at a funeral. That rooted things and felt communal and felt very human and
mm-hmm.
might inspire people to dance. But then I also wanted it to have the emotional weight and empathy and the humanity mm-hmm. and the ugliness and all that stuff that is just human nature.
So you wrote this album, or started this album, barely a day into your so-called vacation. Now, can you take a rest after this little press? Actually, I've seen your tour schedule. No. I know the answer to that question.
No. It's a funny thing because I feel this strange imperative, and I'm not sure where it's from, but I feel this strange imperative to, like, because I'm one of the lucky few who gets to do what I love, I need to do it till my arms fall off. Just to honor it, just to kind of show my gratitude, you know, to music. If there's anything fit to worship, I think it's music.
That's Annie Clark, also known as St. Vincent. Her new album comes out on Tuesday. It's called St. Vincent. Annie Clark, thank you. Real pleasure.
Thank you for having me. This was such a pleasure. Rolling down the highway
like a psychopath. For the week ending February 23rd, 2014, that's the podcast edition of All Things Considered from NPR West, the best of our programs from Saturday and Sunday. The production staff includes Phil Harrell, Becky Hersher, Tom Dreisbach, Priska Neely, Becky Sullivan, Daniel Hajek, and Francesca Fenzi. Our intern is Stephen Jackson. Patrick Murray is our technical director, with technical support from Marcia Caldwell and Leo Dell'Aquila. Muthoni Muturi is our senior editor, and Steve Lichtai is our senior producer. I'm Arun Roth. We'll be back next week. And remember, you can always hear the show on your local public radio station. Thanks for listening. So I am standing in the sand.